Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is May 19th. And I'm going to turn a couple of lights off. I didn't get any lectures online over the weekend, but probably tonight I'll get all the lectures, including today's lecture online. Some people like to listen to them again. And do we have any news from SI? No SI on Wednesday, huh? Okay, and what about Friday? Okay, well, it looks like today is the last SI session, right? More than likely. Okay, so the information there is on the board. All right, so if we look at the schedule, the 19th, practicum number 4, that's right, the 8 o'clock lab had their fourth practicum, and we're going to finish up diversification system, and this afternoon, the Wednesday lab. All right, and then the next period, May 21st, is a lecture examine here covering those chapters, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. Not all of those, not everything in those chapters, just whatever is in the study guide. All right, so just what's in the study guide. And then on Wednesday, the Wednesday labs have their fourth practicum, whether it's the morning or the afternoon. And I'd like to remind the morning group that the morning practicum I'll give at 9 o'clock. Instead of 8 o'clock, just like today, start a little bit later. So that gives you a little bit extra time to study, and I'll open up the study room. So if you want to work in that study room just right outside of lab, I'll probably be in maybe by 7 o'clock, for sure 7:30. Okay? Okay, so come on by. Anybody have a question on the schedule? No? Okay, nice. All right, so we'll put that away, and let's think about what we were talking about last time. Well, we did get into male anatomy, so we're going to finish that up right now. And I went over all of this, and we got down to the testes. All right, so here are the testes. Notice that they're not in the pelvic cavity. And what did I say about that last time? Why aren't the testes in the pelvic cavity? Oh, yeah, temperature, that's right. If it's body temperature, then spermatogenesis won't take place properly. But there's even something worse. What's worse than that? These gonads will turn cancerous, okay? So both testes have to be in the scrotum. And as a matter of fact, everybody checks to make sure that they're there. And if you raise animals at home, if it's a male, you should check as well that the testes are in the scrotum. For any mammal, if they're hidden in the pelvic cavity, call that cryptorchidism, then chances are they're going to turn cancerous and then kill one of your favorite animals. So people always check. Okay, so that means that the sperm, in order to come out the urethral orifice here at the end of the penis, the ejaculate has to enter the pelvic cavity, and it does via the spermatic cord. So here is the spermatic cord. It's got a tube that carries the sperm, and that's what we call the vas deferens. So here's the vas deferens. And you see something yellow in there. There's a testicular nerve. And maybe you see something red. It's kind of hard for me to see, but I see something blue. Do you see something red in here anywhere? Oh, right here? Oh, I think I see something red. Does that look red right here?
It's purple.
Purple. Yeah, I see red, and then I see something over here that looks a little bit blue to me. All right, so notice that this vein, the blue structure, we call that the pampiniform plexus, is a special heat exchange structure, because if arterial blood were to come down through the gonadal artery right to the testes, it would be at room temperature, or body temperature, sorry. It would be at body temperature, and then that would inhibit spermatogenesis. So as blood is returning to the pelvic cavity via this vein, blood is cooler, and this pampiniform plexus just forms a nice network around the artery, so heat transfers from the artery into the vein so that the arterial blood feeding this gonad right here is cooler. Right, so that's the job of the pampiniform plexus. There's a muscle, cremaster muscle as well. All right, so there is the testes. We talked about it a little bit. We talked about the seminiferous tubules. but not in a nice microscopic section. So here's a nice cross-section of a seminiferous tubule. Here's the lumen of that tubule, and facing the lumen of the tubule are all of the sperm that are almost mature. So here I see a sperm with a tail, right? I see a nice headpiece and a tailpiece right here. And they're not quite competent. They got to go someplace before they become competent. Where do they go? I'm sure I mentioned that before. The epididymis. Yeah, epididymis. So right now, they are embedded in a Sertoli cell. And the Sertoli cell supports gametogenesis. Right, so there are Sertoli cells. There are germ cells that can divide to produce a sperm cell. And remember, a sperm cell has half the number of chromosomes as a usual cell, a regular somatic cell in your body. And probably you should be able to tell me why in just a little bit. Okay, so all of these cells in the seminiferous tubule get the Sertoli cells, the germ cells. And outside of the seminiferous tubule, for instance, in this space over here, right, so this is that interstitial space filled with interstitial cells. And sometimes those interstitial cells are called cells of Leydig, L-E-Y-D-I-G. And can anybody imagine what the function of these Leydig cells are? Okay, have I mentioned the male sex hormone yet? Okay, Sertoli cells don't secrete it. Sperm don't secrete it. It is these interstitial cells that secrete testosterone. That's their job, to synthesize and secrete testosterone. All right, and that also is necessary for spermatogenesis besides the action of the Sertoli cells. All right, so testosterone, it's a male sex hormone. Okay, so now, what should we look at? All right, so here is the whole your genital tract, and here's the testes, the epididymis, and then when it's time for ejaculation, the sperm move out of the epididymis into the vas deferens and move very quickly into the pelvic cavity through, what kind of cord is this once again? Not the name of this tube, but there's a cord. That is the vas deferens, but I would like to know what's the name of the cord in which the vas deferens just plays one role. Yeah, the spermatic cord, right? So it's got an artery, that vein, the pampiniform plexus, cremaster, and the gonadal artery. All right, so sperm come over this way. Notice it's coming laterally, and it passes through the seminal vesicle, and the job of the seminal vesicle is to add volume to the ejaculate. And as a matter of fact, the seminal vesicle makes up about 60% of the ejaculate. It contains neutralizing buffers, it contains motility agents, and it has an immunosuppressant that is released so that the female, when she's receiving sperm, doesn't reject the sperm because of an antibody-antigen reaction. And it also puts some nutrients in there like fructose. So there's a large volume that adds to the ejaculate, and it passes right through the prostate gland, and this is the second gland that adds volume to the ejaculate, and it's sort of the same kind of material. It has a neutralizing agent because of the acid environment of the male urethra and female vagina, which normally is very good because that inhibits bacterial growth. So under normal circumstances, that's great, but that will also inhibit sperm motility. The prostate gland also secretes some coagulation protein so that when sperm is deposited in the vagina, it forms a plug, so it just doesn't run right out of the female. And then there's also some liquefying agents from the prostate gland, and those liquefying agents slowly break down that clot of semen so that the sperm are released over a long period of time. Okay, prostate. And then as the ejaculate moves right through the pelvic floor, then there's another gland, the bulbourethral gland that I see here and here. It adds volume to the ejaculate, but only a very small amount, about 5% or so. And most of the volume that's secreted from the bulbourethral gland is mucus. All right, mucus. And mucus is a protein. It's a modified protein. And of course, you know, mucus is an excellent lubricant, but since it's a protein, it also acts as a buffer. So again, it can neutralize the acid environment of the male urethra and female vagina, and that maintains sperm motility. So that is what the bulbourethral gland is. All right, so probably you should know about these three main ones. All right, so on this slide, I also see now the shaft of the penis, and we can see the two corpora cavernosa, which is in the dorsal part of the penis. It's shown laterally right here, so you do have two of them. Not everybody, but males have two of them. And then surrounding the urethra is the corpus spongiosum. So you got one corpus spongiosum and two corpora cavernosa, and these are the erectile tissues in the penis. So veins will vasodilate, and blood then will engorge these erectile tissues and produce an erection. Okay, and the corpus spongiosum right here at this distal end of the penis, then we call this the glans penis. Glans penis. All right, so, yeah.
The difference between the glans penis and the brain pulsus, the foreskin.
Here? Okay, ask your question once again. The foreskin is the prepuce, and here's the external urethral orifice. No, that's not your question.
How different between the glans penis and the brain pulsus? How do you say it?
Ah, okay. Well, this whole area right here is called the glans penis, and if you just want to think of this distal end of the corpus spongiosum as being the glans penis, that's fine with me. Okay. Okay. So here is urinary bladder. No, and what does a urinary bladder hold?
Urine.
Okay. And so here is part of the membranous urethra between the urinary bladder and the prostate as it goes through the perineum or the floor of the pelvic cavity. And then that urethra becomes part of the prostatic, it becomes a prostatic urethra, right, coming from the urinary bladder. And then as it moves through the floor of the perineum, this is the membranous urethra, and then it just becomes the penile or spongy urethra. So it's got three divisions. All right, so what I want you to know about this is that the genital system, reproductive system, and urinary system fuse into one duct in the male. And that's not so in the female that we're going to see. So this urethra is very long in the male, not so long in female. But the reproductive tract is still always going to be separate. Okay, you can see these seminal vesicles, urethrorectal tissue. Okay, and I think that's it for the male reproductive system. Unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question on that? Okay, I guess I have a question for you. Why does a sperm have half the number of chromosomes compared to a normal cell in your body that we call a somatic cell? All right, so a sperm is a kind of gamete. Gametes have half the number. Females have gametes too. What's a female gamete called? Oocyte or an egg, okay? And an oocyte or an egg has half the number of chromosomes as well compared to a normal somatic human cell. Why do you think that is? Yeah, because in the process of fertilization, right, the chromosomes from the sperm add to the chromosomes that are in the egg, and since they both had half, now they have the full complement that a normal human cell should have, which is 46, okay? All right, that process by which these sperm are produced, or at least the genetic material, half the number of chromosomes is what we call meiosis. All right, so female reproductive system. The main reproductive organ is the ovary, which we see right here. This is sort of a projected view. It's a sagittal section, but we're looking at things way lateral as well. And the job of the ovary is to produce gametes, like an oocyte, and to secrete sex hormones. And unlike the male, there are two in the female. There's estrogen and progesterone. And the other job of the ovary is to produce oocytes, And there's a big difference between an oocyte and a sperm. Does anybody can think of a difference between a structural difference, which means a big functional difference between a sperm and an oocyte? No flagellum. That's right. An oocyte has no flagellum. So an oocyte can't swim around anywhere. Right? Like a sperm, if sperm are deposited here in the vagina, they move through the cervical canal, then through the uterus, up the fallopian tube and out the fallopian tube, and they can swim anywhere in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity because they're motile. They have flagella. But that egg can't. So that poses some potential problems because we know that that egg should enter the fallopian tube and make its way to the uterus. And even though the egg can't swim around, this fimbriated edge of the fallopian tube, this is what we call the fimbria, and the fallopian tube itself have ciliated cells that line the mucosa. And guess which way the cilia are sweeping? They're sweeping, right, the peritoneal fluid toward the uterus so that that egg gets trapped in that flow and makes its way down through the fallopian tube. And fertilization usually takes place, as far as anybody knows, in the fallopian tube. Okay, so under normal circumstances. However, if there's scar in the fallopian tube, and scar could just be loss of function, a functional scar, maybe the cilia aren't beating properly, then once the ovary ovulates, spits out an egg, it ends up in the pelvic cavity, and sperm, remember, can swim anywhere around here. Fertilization can take place, and then that embryo will implant into the mesentery instead of implanting into the uterus. So what do we call that when we have a fertilized egg implanting into mesentery or to some other structures of the abdominal or pelvic cavity? What do we call that? All right, it's a pregnancy, but a special kind. It's called an ectopic pregnancy. All right, ectopic just means somewhere other than the usual place, but it's actually very serious. It should actually have another name associated with it because under most circumstances, if left alone, that will cause the death of the woman. Right? So ectopic pregnancies are really dangerous. If there's any scarring to the fallopian tube. Now, how does that fallopian tube get scarred? Well, sexually transmitted diseases or urinary tract infections, anything like that, right? Because the urethra is so short, urinary tract infections can enter the reproductive tract and infect the fallopian tube, in which case then that egg, all right, will not make its way down to the uterus. So an egg actually can even implant into the fallopian tube, and that's an ectopic pregnancy as well. And that is just as deadly as an ectopic pregnancy anywhere else. All right, so they used to hang signs in the emergency room, think ectopic, because a lot of women would walk into the emergency room with severe abdominal or pelvic pain, and they couldn't diagnose it as an appendicitis or anything else. And so the recommendation was to go home, have a couple aspirin, and then if the pain is still there in the morning, come back. And you know what? A lot of women never made it back to the emergency room because they hemorrhaged out. They just bled out as a result of that ectopic pregnancy breaking away from the vascular supply. All right, so that sign was hung so that now there are some things that a physician always thinks about. All right, if a woman comes in with that kind of pain, first the physician has to know, well, is this woman of childbearing years? Is she in the right age group? And is she sexually active? And if there's affirmative for each one of those kinds of questions, then that ectopic pregnancy has to be ruled out. And that can be done with a blood test, and if the blood test is positive, then ultrasound, because it's just a really deadly thing if you let go. All right, so that's the job of this fallopian tube. Here is the uterus, and the uterus has three main layers. Here's the endometrium, the middle layer is a myometrium, and on the outside we have the perimetrium, sort of just like around the heart, three main layers. And so you can see how thick the muscle wall of the uterus is, and guess how strong you think the uterus is? Sort of strong? Strong? Really strong? Well, you know what? Everybody's shaking their head, yes. Okay. It's probably the strongest muscle in anybody's body, male or female. All right, just think of that. Who do you know that's really muscular? A guy who's really muscular. Arnold Schwarzenegger? I heard maybe. Well, maybe he was at one point in time. All right, but even back then when he was super, super strong, could Arnold Schwarzenegger take a 10-pound weight and hold it out from his body like that for 9 months? No way, right? So that gives you a little bit of an appreciation of how strong this uterus is and the cervix as well. Okay, so here's the cervix. It forms a dome on that distal end of the uterus, and these internal sections right here are what we call the fornices. So here's the anterior, here's the posterior fornix, and then there are lateral fornices as well. So it's really a circle that goes around the cervix. And then, of course, here is the vagina that accepts the male penis during intercourse for sperm deposition. But what's another function of the vagina?
Birth canal.
Ah, birth canal. Yeah, I like that. Birth canal. Yeah, it's a birth canal. Right, so that the fetus, right, can come right out, right through here. Female does have erectile tissue, and this is the clitoris. It's a sensory organ. And then here is the greater vestibular gland, very similar to the bulbourethral gland in the male, secretes mucus. And the vestibule, which is outlined by the labia minorum and majorum, so there is like a little space right here, and normally it's very acidic, and secretions from the vestibular gland, Bartholin's gland, during intercourse, right, just neutralizes some of those acids that are in this region. Normally those acids are necessary to prevent infection, but acid will also immobilize sperm. Okay, so that's the job of the bulbourethral gland. Okay, I think that's all I want to say, but I got a question for you. Okay, I got a question for you. Before we look at this slide right here, what about cancer? We talked about cancer in terms of the large intestine, cancer in terms of the reproductive tract. Oh, I didn't mention prostate gland. Oh, prostate gland. In a lot of countries, prostate can, well, in a lot of men, it can turn cancerous, and in some countries, that's the leading cause of death in men, and of course, then it's the leading cause of cancer deaths as well. Okay, and so let me just go back, and can you remember where that prostate gland was? Okay, here's that prostate gland right below the urinary bladder, and this is kind of a strange occurrence that's happening right here, because there is a pathology that will affect every single male if you're lucky enough to live a long time. And does anybody know what that is, what every male is going to experience? Okay, it's called hypertrophy of the prostate gland, or enlargement of the prostate gland. It's going to grow and get bigger and bigger, and when it does, take a guess on what happens. It blocks the prostatic urethra, so that men have difficulty voiding or can only void a very short amount, and then they have to void again a little time afterwards. All right, so sometimes that process is benign. It's not cancerous, except you still have impediment to voiding. But sometimes when the prostate gland enlarges or hypertrophies, right, it does turn cancerous. And then what does cancer mean? Well, these cells can break away from the prostate and go into bone or brain or lung or muscle, and tumors will start to form there as well. All right, so that's what we call metastatic disease. And why is this really strange that every male will have to deal with this? I think we mentioned this last time. Maybe. Why is that really strange? Because if you were to look around the room, would you see another you? We're all different. And usually, right, this is really one of the rare circumstances that I can think of that every male, if you're lucky enough to live a long life, we'll have to deal with. Usually there's so much diversity in the population that some pathological process doesn't happen in all of us, right? But that is something that has to be looked after, right? Because if it is cancer, certainly you want it treated. All right, talking about cancer, how about cancer? Can cancer be a sexually transmitted disease? Can cancer be a sexually transmitted disease? I should probably walk out of the room and have you guys discuss it. Okay? How would you think about cancer being a sexually transmitted disease? Of course, we heard of gonorrhea and other kinds of things, bacterial infections, but what about cancer? I think I heard somebody talk about cervical cancer. Okay, and of course, women get cervical cancer. Males don't get cervical cancer. And one of the main ways that somebody gets cervical cancer is by an infection of the cervix right here by the human papillomavirus. Human papillomavirus has over 100 different kinds of strains. Most, we, as far as we know, don't produce pathology, but there are four strains that when they infect the cervix will cause the cells of the cervix to change, right, and eventually turn cancerous over a long period of time. It could take maybe 10 years for that to happen. All right, so the answer is yes. Cancer is a sexually transmitted disease because the human papillomavirus. Right, so it's very important if you're of childbearing years to do what once a year? It's called, yeah, pap smear, where they look at the cells of the cervix right here to see if there's any dysplasia or if there's any hypertrophy of the cervix. And many, many women die of cervical cancer, and it's really a shame, right? Because it can be 100% prevented, right? By what? Just abstaining, right? Or using maybe a condom during sex. And the other thing is, if it's caught early enough, it's 100% treatable. So if it's caught early, then with a little cryosurgery, some of these cells then are ablated from the cervix, and then somebody doesn't have cervical cancer. And like I said, it takes years, maybe even a decade, for those cells to turn cancerous, so you have a long time to catch it. So it's really a shame that anybody gets cervical cancer. Okay. Oh, you know, with the prostate, there is a blood marker called PSA, a prostate-specific antigen, but I don't know of a plasma or blood marker for cervical cancer. There probably is a way to check for antibodies against that virus, human papillomavirus, but it might not be specific enough to the strains that cause cancer, or if it is available, it's just outlandishly expensive. Oh, that's something else that's really nice. Yeah, there's something else that's really, I forgot to mention that. Okay, so some of you still might have trouble believing that cancer is a sexually transmitted disease, but you know what? What you had just mentioned is that you can be immunized against that disease process. Okay, and one of the trade names I think was Gardasil, and Gardasil prevents the infection of the cervix, and then you're protected from cervical cancer, at least from that way of getting it. There are other ways of getting cervical cancer, which we don't really have time to talk about. So, what kinds of things do you get a vaccine for? For infections, right? You get a vaccine for infections, like chickenpox and mumps and measles and all that kind of stuff. So you can get a vaccination against those human papillomaviruses, right, which cause cervical cancer over a long period of time. So, for instance, if you've been married for 5 years, and in 5 years from now, you're diagnosed with cervical cancer, okay, and you might be really mad at your husband, right, thinking that maybe he transmitted a human papillomavirus to you because you've been married a long time, but guess what? How long could you have been infected? Even way before you were married. It's really hard to tell. Okay, so just remember, it does get transmitted that way. And in the male, those viruses don't produce any known symptoms. We're actually symptom-free. So again, that shows you how dangerous that is. There might be a link between some viruses and prostate cancer and other kinds of cancers of the reproductive tract, but it's never been shown scientifically if that's true. All right, so let's look. Any questions on that? All right, you know, today still, if you do a search on sexually transmitted disease and cancer, probably half the websites will still tell you that cancer is not a sexually transmitted disease. And maybe 20 or 30% will. So it's not really well known. And it should be really well known because way too many women are dying out of just ignorance, just not knowing that. Okay, so here you see the three layers of the uterus, endo, myo, and perimetrium. Myo is the muscle. Endometrium is a special lining that changes through the reproductive cycle. We're going to take a look at that in just a little bit. Here's that fallopian tube, right? The fimbriated edge partially surrounds the ovary, and these fimbria also have some muscles, and they're continually sweeping as well over the surface of the ovary very slowly. And they are ciliated so that there is a flow of fluid through the fallopian tube down through the uterus. So down past the fimbria, the infundibulum, the ampule, which is a little swelling, and then down past this little narrowing right here that we call the isthmus of the fallopian tube. And your book calls it uterine tube. Of course, you could use either one in lab. It's fine. Oh, here it says fallopian tube. Okay, so here is the body of the uterus, and the superior end is called the fundus. And that should remind you of another organ that has a fundus right on the superior end. What's that? Yeah, the stomach. Yeah, the stomach has that fundic region as well. Okay, here is a broad ligament, that joint that stabilizes the ovary up against the fallopian tube as well as the uterus, so it covers this whole space right here, hence the name, broad ligament. There's also an ovarian ligament that goes from the uterus to the ovary, and then there's a round ligament as well that goes from the wall of the pelvis over to the uterus. So those, I think you have to know where they are in lab. Oh, these openings, right, to the cervical canal. Here's the internal os. All right, here's the external os. That's how we talk about these things. Okay, and then the cervical canal. Okay, well, we got to look at some hormones. All right, so the main sex hormone in the male, what did we say the sex hormone was in the male? Testosterone, right? And so that produces male sex characteristics and makes the male reproductive system functional, helps support spermatogenesis. But there are two sex hormones in the female, and I do need to talk about those a little bit. Okay, and all right, and here they are, estrogen and progesterone. So here is the uterine cycle. Sometimes it's called the menstrual cycle. And it's about 28 days long. And I see a couple blood profiles or profiles of two hormones in the blood during this cycle. And day one is the beginning of menses. And that's when the endometrium is sloughed off with a period of mild hemorrhage out of the uterus. On day five, right, then menstruation should be complete and the cycle then progresses. Estrogen starts to increase. Estrogen comes from a developing follicle inside an ovary. I'll have to show you where that is in just a second. And progesterone during this time stays where? How is progesterone? It stays very, very low. All right, so progesterone, the original name for progesterone is called progestational hormone. What is gestation?
Pregnant.
Yeah, that's a period of time when somebody is pregnant. So progesterone is the hormone that maintains the endometrium of the uterus as well as the myometrium during pregnancy. Estrogen is necessary, but it's mostly progesterone. All right, so as the estrogens increase, then the endometrium lining starts to grow and it gets thicker and there's some glands that develop. And whenever you have a tissue that starts to grow, we call that proliferation, right? Starting with one cell, then two, then four, then 16, right? On and on exponentially. That is proliferation. Okay, so here is the endometrium, the inner lining of the uterus. And you can see that the endometrium starts to grow under the influence of estrogen from a developing follicle. And you can see that the blood vessels start to develop and some uterine glands start to develop. I don't know of any, what the reason is for these uterine glands. If somebody knows, you should probably let me know. Maybe nobody knows why they're there, but hopefully it probably aids in implantation to some degree. Okay, and then right at this point in time, right at mid-cycle, okay, let's go back to mid-cycle. Okay, mid-cycle right here, something special happens. All right, an egg is ovulated from the ovary, and at that point in time, then estrogen starts to decrease. Oh, I'm sorry, day 14 is right at mid-cycle. Then estrogen start to decrease and hormone, progesterone, start to increase. This increase in progesterone puts the final growing touches on the endometrium. It matures the glands that are secreting something. So this last phase is called the secretory phase. Secretory phase is mostly due to progestational hormone because it makes the uterus think or behave as if it were pregnant, because then implantation can successfully take place. All right, so estrogen is going down, progesterone is going up, and then if fertilization doesn't take place, then of course they both regress. Both progesterone and estrogen regress. All right, and we see that here. As they regress, then that initiates another period of menses. All right, but what secretes that estrogen and progesterone? Let's go back to here. And as a matter of fact, I want to even go back just a little bit further. So here is an ovary, and I see a bunch of little structures that we call follicles in an ovary. And these are the things that can turn into a gamete. And after a woman is born, she can't produce any more follicles. And I think right when she's born, or right before she's born, she has about 2 million follicles in both ovaries. Males, on the other hand, can produce an unlimited number of sperm. But a female has a set number of follicles, which will produce an egg. And by the time a woman reaches reproductive years, she has about 250,000 potential follicles that can make an egg. So are there any women in here that are a little disappointed that they're so unlike the male that can produce new sperm throughout their lifetime? Probably not, because you can't imagine having 250,000 kids anyway, right? So that's really not an important matter. All right, so here we see some follicles, and a couple of them start to grow, right? And they surround an egg. And right around this point in time, usually only one follicle survives and the rest regress. And here is the oocyte inside the follicle. And right here, we have a mature follicle. Sometimes we call that a Graafian follicle with a fluid-filled antrum. And here we see ovulation taking place right at day 14. And this oocyte with some surrounding cells get expelled from the ovary, and that can produce a mild hemorrhage as well. All right, and then the leftover follicle becomes this structure right here. Right, it's eventually going to regress, but at the moment, right after ovulation, it's a very important endocrine structure. It's a very important endocrine gland, and we can see that it persists for a fairly long period of time. Right, so this developing follicle produces estrogen. And can you remember what estrogen looked like, the profile of estrogen? It started low, and then it grew higher and higher and higher and higher, and that's because this follicle is growing bigger and bigger and bigger. And then right at ovulation, we saw a big drop in estrogen production because the follicle no longer exists. It becomes this structure right here that we call the corpus luteum, and the job of the corpus luteum then is to secrete progesterone. All right, so here is, okay, the different phases of the ovulatory cycle. So progesterone is produced by the corpus luteum, and estrogen primarily produced by the developing follicle. All right, so here are the phases. Okay, proliferative phase, secretory phase, right at mid-cycle. These are the hormones that come from the pituitary gland that cause ovulation. All right, so here is FSH. FSH, all right, is relatively high. This causes a follicle to grow and develop. And then right at mid-cycle, luteinizing hormone, there's a big spike in luteinizing hormone, and that's what causes ovulation, and then the level of luteinizing hormone goes way down. All right, so you could put like ovulation right here. So these hormones, LH and FSH, come from the pituitary. These are what we call gonadotropins. We talked about them before. And what causes the release of these gonadotropins is a signal from the hypothalamus that goes through that portal vessel from the hypothalamus into the anterior pituitary. That's called gonadotropin-releasing hormone. So both of these are what we call gonadotropins, because what is the organ that they have an effect on? The gonads, right? Female gonads. And also male gonads, but we're talking about a woman in this particular case. So FSH causes maturation of a follicle. LH causes ovulation. In the male, FSH, primarily important for spermatogenesis, just like oogenesis in the female, right? But LH, since the male doesn't ovulate, LH is used to as a signal for those interstitial cells to make testosterone. So LH is a signal for testosterone production. To get who? Pregnant? Well, sperm, I think as far as we know, can stay viable for 24, maybe 48 hours. All right? And so it probably takes a day for this oocyte to move into the fallopian tube, where usually fertilization takes place. And I don't know if there's a control mechanism that makes that happen, but it's very rare for an egg to be fertilized in the pelvic cavity or in that first segment of the fallopian tube near a fimbria. Okay, and maybe it does, but because of the cilia, that fertilized egg makes its way to the uterus. It gets swept into the uterus. So when can somebody become pregnant? Well, this is just a textbook. All right, so I think anybody can become pregnant anywhere during this menstrual cycle, because you might not know exactly where you are in this cycle, and things have a way of mixing around a little bit. But certainly from, you know, day 14 to day 20 is a period of time when somebody can be easily impregnated, right? Okay. Okay, but I wouldn't use that as a form of birth control, okay, if that is important for you. And probably it should be for everybody. All right, so here we have the follicle that develops during the ovarian cycle, right? And what's the job of this follicle, once again? To secrete estrogen, and then right at ovulation, so here's ovulation at day 14, then this leftover follicle becomes the corpus luteum, and what's the job of the corpus luteum? To secrete progesterone, right? And it stays pretty high for a short period of time. So what are the effects of these, of estrogen and progesterones? Primarily, okay, well, we're just talking about the uterus. It causes estrogen causes the proliferative phase of the endometrium. Lower levels of estrogen and higher levels of progesterone, right, make sure that the endometrium, the functional layer of the endometrium, becomes viable for implantation, and that these uterine glands develop, right? And then right at this time, you see the endometrium starting to regress. What does that correspond to, this regression of the endometrium? I guess we'll go back, take a look. It shows what? A decrease in progesterone. Right? So when progesterone starts to decrease, right, then the endometrium starts to regress as well. All right, so for this particular individual, are they pregnant or not? No, they're not pregnant, right? Because the endometrium is going away. Now, if somebody is pregnant, if implantation did take place, what do you think should happen to this endometrium? Should it go away? Should it dissolve away? No, it should get bigger and stronger, right? And the myometrium should get bigger and stronger. And that's the job of progesterone, once again. But you said, we saw, oh, but progesterone is starting to go away right here. Well, this is what happens, okay? All right, progesterone comes from this corpus luteum, and right? It will regress if implantation does not take place. But if implantation does take place, then this corpus luteum stays nice and healthy for about 3 weeks, somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks. I forgot the number. Right, so 4 weeks, the corpus luteum stays viable and secretes progesterone, and that maintains the endometrium. So you might wonder, why doesn't the corpus luteum regress if somebody's pregnant? Why doesn't it just regress, like under normal circumstances right here? All right, so here implantation for sure did not take place, but it did. If it did, the endometrium would stay nice and viable because of progesterone being secreted from the corpus luteum. Well, in implantation, there's a special organ that develops, and we studied this in lab. It's part maternal tissue, part fetal tissue, and it's responsible for exchange of gases between the mom and the fetus and nutrients and toxic products, and that's the placenta. All right, and so as the placenta develops, it sends a signal to the corpus luteum to not regress, to stay viable. And that signal is called human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG. Some of you might be familiar with that because that's what the home pregnancy test measures, human chorionic gonadotropin. All right, so if implantation takes place, the placenta secretes that hormone. That hormone goes to the corpus luteum and keeps the corpus luteum viable. So what does the corpus luteum have that allows it to sense levels of human chorionic gonadotropin? What is it that you have to have to sense anything? A receptor. It's got to have a receptor, right? So this is not a photoreceptor like your eyes, but it's a molecular receptor that has a shape that allows human chorionic gonadotropin to bind to it, and when it does, it maintains this corpus luteum so it does not regress. Okay, so this is the ovarian cycle, and you can see that the first part, the follicular phase, because these are developing follicles, release estrogen, the corpus luteum secretes progesterone, okay, and what causes ovulation once again? What hormone causes ovulation? LH, right? And what causes this follicle to mature? Follicle stimulating hormone. And where does FSH and LH, where do they come from? Where do these come from? It says plasma hormone. Yeah, but how do they get into the blood? From the anterior pituitary gland. Anterior pituitary gland. These are the gonadotropins. All right, and as this follicle matures, it secretes estrogen, which then allows the endometrium to grow. And then the corpus luteum puts the final touches of maturation on the endometrium and makes sure that it doesn't regress if implantation does take place, right? So what's another name for progesterone? Progestational hormone, progestational hormone. So yeah, if there's high levels of progesterone, then the body thinks it is pregnant. And that's probably the major component in birth control pills. Because when progesterone is high, let's take a look at this. When progesterone is high, what about levels of FSH? They're way low, right? So when somebody's on a birth control pill with some progesterone, that stops the maturation of a follicle. And so that's a good contraceptive, right? So progesterone feeds back to the anterior pituitary, so it does not release follicle-stimulating hormone. So the follicles don't mature. Right, there's a similar effect in males. Okay, sometimes males take androgens to boost their athletic performance, and sometimes we call that doping, and that testosterone will maybe make somebody's muscles bigger and stronger because that's a secondary sex characteristic in males compared to females. But the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary can sense that testosterone. So if testosterone is really high, guess what happens to FSH in the male and LH in the male? It starts to go away. It turns the anterior pituitary off and the hypothalamus off, so that anterior pituitary doesn't release FSH. And then what happens to the male testes? They regress, right? They just regress when somebody is taking exogenous testosterone, right? They just turn into like little raisins. because it needs, the testes need these gonadotropins, right, to maintain their structure and their function. Okay. I think that's all I need to say, except probably I would like to ask you, when somebody is pregnant, why does not the corpus luteum regress like we see right here? What keeps this corpus luteum around secreting something? I tell you what does it secrete?
Progesterone,
right? Secretes progesterone during this luteal phase because here's the corpus luteum, right? And so when somebody is pregnant, the initial weeks, what maintains the corpus luteum so that it doesn't regress? There is a hormone from the placenta called HCG, or if you want to know it as human chorionic gonadotropin, that's fine too. HCG. The chorion is a special part of the placenta, okay, that releases a hormone, and the corpus luteum has a receptor for it, and it stays nice and healthy, secreting progesterone if somebody is pregnant. Okay. I think that's all I wanted to show you for the reproductive system. But I guess I had one question. I had another question. I posed it here, maybe in lab, I can't remember. But how come there's only two sexes? How come not three sexes? New and unique, something is, it's a process to make something a new and unique human. Yeah, but so two sexes do that. Three sexes probably would as well, or four, or five. And the answer is because if two sexes produces a new and unique person every single time, there's no need for another sex, right? If two works every single time, there's no need for three or four because everybody's different anyway. And oh, here's a sign-in sheet. Ha ha. See? Oh, we have time. Let's sign it. Pass it around. Okay, because everybody's new and unique. Why is it a good thing that everybody's different? I'll get to your question in a second. Because it's very rare that we all come down with the same disease process, right? We're all different, so that makes the human population very strong if we're all different. Yeah, question.
After ovulation?
Yes. Yeah. Where does estrogen come from? The corpus luteum, but not very much. It's mostly progesterone. But those cells are still there, but they just change their activity. So some estrogen is secreted by the corpus luteum. But if you think of just one in particular, I want you to think that the corpus luteum secretes progesterone. Okay? And the developing follicle secretes estrogen. So for right now, that's just really good to think about it just like that. Okay? Follicle, estrogen, corpus luteum, progesterone. All right, so next time, what do you need next time? I didn't send out an email to everybody, but you need a picture ID. If you don't have a picture ID, maybe don't even come take the test, right? Because I don't know what I'm going to do with you because I got to submit grades right away. So make sure you bring a picture ID, a pencil, eraser. And it can't just be any old eraser. It's got to be a good eraser. And what's the Scantron that you need? An 882. Yeah, 882E or an 882ES. Are the best ones, right? Don't get ones with numbers in the little bubble or the ones that have shading in the bubble. Sometimes that fouls up the Scantron reader. Okay, any other questions? This could be like a little study session. Any other questions? You know where to find the study guides and all that kind of stuff? Yeah, absolutely. After the practicum, you can go study. But it's just on these two figures that we went over right here. All right, semester's crashing very quickly. Well, you know what? I probably won't say anything. So if you sign the sign-in sheet, unless you want to hang out, you're welcome to leave. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there was something I forgot to mention. Endometriosis. What the heck is endometriosis? Anybody want to learn a little bit about endometriosis? Endometriosis can be a very irritating condition for some women, right? Endometriosis. Ah, here. Even better yet. Okay, who wants to learn something about endometriosis? No? No? Ah. How many layers does the uterus have? Yeah. And what's the inner one called? Endometrium. Yeah, what happens to the endometrium once every month? Yeah, it sloughs off, right? It sloughs off. And when it sloughs off with a mild hemorrhage, it usually leaves the body through vagina. But every once in a while, hey, you guys, hush up while I explain to some people that want to hear this. Danielle, shh. Okay, so every once in a while, that some of those endometrial cells, instead of getting sloughed through the cervical canal and vagina, they can make their way up through the fallopian tube, right, and out the fimbriated end, and end up someplace in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, and they still can be viable cells, right, and they implant into some mesentery or somewhere in your capillaries, and then they start to grow. And since they're going to be sensitive to estrogen and progesterone, guess what happens? When somebody is secreting a lot of estrogen during the follicular phase, then those cells, those endometrial cells, start to grow and cause a severe irritation of the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, right? And then it's maintained through the luteal phase, and then it regresses at the end of the menstrual cycle. And then it starts up again. They start to grow the next menstrual cycle. It's not really, almost it seems like cancer, but those cells can't invade other regions of the body. They can't go to liver or brain or bone, muscle like that, but they certainly can live, right, and be viable within the pelvic or abdominal cavity. And some women actually need to undergo surgery to get rid of some of those endometrial cells that escape to reduce that inflammation. That's usually a pretty hard call, I would guess, because anytime you do surgery, you cause what? More inflammation, right? More scarring. And I think the good thing about that is that after menopause, then endometriosis pretty much subsides because that surge of estrogen and progesterone are no longer there to trigger those cells to grow. All right, so that's why it's really good to know something about these layers of the uterus, right? And something about that ectopic pregnancy and this fallopian tube. And I think somebody can have endometriosis even though their fallopian tube is normal, even though it has normal function. But they're probably at a higher risk if there is scarring of the fallopian tube.
Are they able to bleed?
Yeah. The normal endometriosis, you know, I'm not sure. I think it just regresses, but I don't think there is that vascular development to cause, like an internal menses. I don't think that happens. But that's interesting. I don't know.
I don't know if you talk about the pigments and what their function was.
Oh, yeah, in the ejaculate?
Yeah.
There are pigments in there that when you shine an ultralight on them, they fluoresce.
Okay, so that's all that.
Yeah, that's all that.
Then?
We don't know.
Okay.
They're there so that they shine
so
up bright when...
Charge people for criminals.
right. It's just a marker. Let's see, when are we supposed to...